It's not an unusual experience. There's many families and many individuals that have gone through this and gone through worse. I think of a person like maybe Ibrahim, who had gone through extreme difficulty, and others. There's one lady that actually recruited me into doing things. There was not a year that she was not in prison. Rita Nzanga. She's one of those unrecognized heroines who goes unnoticed.
Being raised in an activist family, former South African ambassador to Libya, Syria and Saudi Arabia, Mohammed Dango and his siblings joined the struggle at an early age. Five of the nine siblings actively took part in the struggle, one dying as a member of ZAPO, another banned by the apartheid state, another a former member of Umkhonto weSizwe, and his sister, Deputy Secretary General of the African National Congress, Jessie Duarte. I recently sat down with the former ambassador whose activism came at a price. Two attempts were made on Dango's life for his running of an underground branch as part of the African National Congress.
They shot at my house. That was one obvious way. And another time I had to go to pick up Winnie Mandela at the airport, the year she broke her banishment order. There was one weekend that she decided that she was going to break her banishment order. And she'd come back from Cape Town. I went to fetch her at the airport. They shot at the car. I thought they wanted to shoot at Mrs. Mandela. In fact, when the person confessed, he confessed to having been instructed to kill me. At the TRC, when he said he needed to kill me because I was running an underground branch and they couldn't catch me.
While he understood the process of the Truth and Reconciliation Council, Dango says that in having to come face to face with the hired gun, he froze in the moment.
I understood the rationale. I intellectually understood the process of the TRC and understood the necessity for it. The necessity was to heal the nation. The necessity was to take forward. The necessity was to actually get us to a point where we could move away from this kind of hatred that we did. But when he came to ask me for forgiveness, I froze. And the Archbishop, of course, challenged me to actually live up to the commitment to forgive and to reconcile.
What did you feel like you had to forgive?
If somebody wanted to kill you, then that's what you had to look at. When I'm looking at the trial now and the inquest of Ahmed Timor, I'm reminded that the methodology and the modus operandi was to kill people if necessary. But it will also then extend to people like Imam Harun. In fact, the lady I spoke about, Rita Nzanga, her husband, was also killed in prison, Lawrence Nzanga. So there were many people killed in prison. People suffered more than we did, and we need to recognize that.
I feel like when you speak about your own experience, you tend to mitigate the pain or the suffering or the discomfort that you were forced to experience. Why is that?
I don't mitigate it. I recognize that we had to go through that healing process. It was absolutely necessary.
When you were about to forgive the person, you had to, in a way, be coerced. Not because you didn't want to, but because you froze in the moment.
I just froze in the moment.
You froze in the moment. When you forgave the person, did you forgive the person, or was it worse?
No, I actually felt free thereafter.
What does that freedom mean?
Free from this burden of having known, because I'd known that this was going to happen because I received the note, so I knew what was going to come up. And having recognized that, I then understood that I had to go through that process. The process was that we were healing a nation, that we're trying to bring together people.
But did you heal yourself?
Difficult question. Yes, I did. I think I did. Do I actually need counseling for that? I don't believe I do. I'll live through worse thereafter.
Was the healing that you needed, you said earlier, you did not speak to the person who instructed the hitman.
So in that instance, I believe that that person should still be brought to justice. Because that person did not confess.
Have you asked for him to be brought to justice?
No, I have not.
Why not?
Just neglect and maybe not seriousness about it. But now after the Timor trial, I think the Timor inquest recently has rekindled that kind of spirit within me, because I then recognized that this was the modus operandi. It was being operated under. And this is how other people, in fact, got killed. They slipped on bars of soap, they were dropped from windows. Those kind of things actually need to come out, because those people have not confessed.
And your emotions, when you think about this person, now that the Ahmad Timol case is bringing into question injustices that have not been brought to justice, what emotions do you go through?
I still recognize that the process of forgiveness was necessary, that the process of healing was absolutely necessary.
When you watch the TRC videos, you know, you go back to it, you see anger in people's faces, you see hurt in mothers who have lost sons, you see hurt in people who themselves were attacked, who themselves were imprisoned. Did the TRC, with the wording of "I forgive you," really and truly, was it a cathartic experience that we can say South Africa is healed?
I think it was a necessary experience for the period. If not, we would have had a Nuremberg kind of situation. And a Nuremberg situation would not have taken us forward collectively as a nation. I look at that and look at what I've seen in the Middle East, and this sense of not forgiving, or this sense of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is actually a disaster that doesn't allow people to come together. If I take the situation in Libya, for example, it has descended into where people, because they've been under pressure, because they're looking for comfort and for protection, have withdrawn into the language group, into the clan, and into the tribe. So where tribalism was probably under the surface, was never evident before, become very prominent. In Syria, I took on sectarian, and that was promoted to get to that kind of situation. And as I said, you need to recognize people's right to be different and not only tolerate. Because if I don't really like, but I'm just merely tolerating you, that's just, I'm tolerating you, that it is. But if I recognize your right to be different and interact with you on that basis, then I think it's important. It's not even accommodation of societies. These were societies that naturally lived together, that intermarried. I mean, take Libya. 98% of the population is Muslim. And 98% of that are Maliki. What are they fighting about? They're fighting about resources. It is the curse of resources, as President Mbeki put it, that is actually playing itself out there.
Going back to the topic at hand, in terms of Ahmad Timol case, it brings to question a lot of, you know, what happened in the past. Do you think that it was a positive move that this case was taken forward by the family, by the interested parties? Do you think it was a positive move toward healing, or do you think, as you said, it actually opened up wounds of your own?
I think it was important, because it's one of the cases that was not dealt with adequately in the process. And there are other cases. There's the case of Imam Harun, there's the case of Lawrence Nzanga. All of those kind of cases need to be looked at, and to bring about a sense that, yes, justice was done, but that the truth really be told, even if nobody's found guilty or sent to jail.
So do you think that these individual cases actually are the face of community's justice? So even if it's just these three cases, it just shows that the communities have been granted justice, because these were icons in the community.
I think, yes, that not only the community, but also the families know the truth. Nobody slipped in a bar of soap. Nobody committed suicide jumping out of a window. And I think the families actually want to prove that that did not happen. And I think that becomes important.
If you had to stand in front of the person who instructed that you be killed, what did you say to the person?
I think what I would do is, if I understood his confession and his reality and the fact that he owned up to it, he would probably be 95 or 98 by now. I'd offer him a seat. I'd be courteous to him. I'd try and point out the error of his ways to him.
And the emotions, do you think your emotions would be reflecting your actions?
I think it would.
So no anger?
Anger can only bring destruction within the self and outside.
But in terms of the issue of South Africa and the TRC, I can understand and I can appreciate the fact that we have to move forward from a place of pain to forgiveness. But with the TRC or with the South African process, it was a pluralistic process and not individualistic in the sense that we focused on each individual's pain. It was, we are going to forgive and we are going to move forward. In doing so, did it not force people into a state of, okay, I'll forgive, but then live with post-traumatic stress afterwards?
I think with hindsight, that can be a position. But at that particular point in time, it was absolutely necessary. It's absolutely necessary to go into the compromises that people and the wisdom of the leadership. I mean, our national anthem is a compromise. Our flag is the result of a compromise. The fact that we created so many provinces is a compromise. Otherwise, you would have had some provinces or some people wanting to secede from the national union. And all of the wisdom was that to bring all of that together. And what we need to review now is that still necessary to have those kind of provinces? But I think we've gone past the question of whether we need to reconcile or not. Yes, it was absolutely necessary for the reconciliation. In Baghdad, I went to go and visit there some time ago. I was invited by the UN to speak on the South African process. And as I sat and listened to the committee, I discovered that this committee did not really look at, and some of the UN officials did not believe that sulh was a Muslim tradition, that it was only Judeo-Christian. Until one of the sheikhs sitting there was amongst the committee, started to point out, you know, there was Fathul Makkah. And what did the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam do in Makkah when he came in? He forgave. What was Hudaybiyah about? It was that process of also methodology and strategy to get to a particular point. The TRC has finished its work. What it did not address was the question of compensation for victims, by and large. And that needs to be revisited. But those individuals that did not seek to confess at the TRC, those individuals should in fact be brought to justice.
You've been to countries that have gone from the most respected civilizations to just being destroyed. If you had to advise these nations or these nation builders in terms of the peace process and drawing on your experience with the TRC, what advice would you give them in terms of their peace building? Would you say, let people forgive on their own time, or let people forgive in unity?
I think if you want to achieve a peaceful outcome, you'll have to forgive in unity. If you want to achieve outcomes that can actually bring people together, it has to be a conscious general situation where the population actually looks at that and looks at their own history of having lived together for many years. Recognize the right of the other to be different.
In terms of what was lacking, what we can still implement, what do you think we can implement?
We need to get to that position where we restore the dignity of people by getting them to earn for themselves and not becoming beggars. I think unless there's a sharing of the resources of the country, we're going to head for social upheaval. And those that actually have resources need to understand that they can't have this ostentatious lifestyles while other people live in poverty. They need to understand that they would need to move forward in such a way that they actually assist in the development of people. The Freedom Charter says South Africa belongs to all, black and white. And that is the Magna Carta that actually guides what we do and drives us towards a non-racial youth. But I think there's also other issues in, for example, Cape Town, is that poor people who lived on the mountain are now being forced out by rates and taxes that are unaffordable for them, where they've lived for generations. And other people who can afford in this gentrification program are moving in. Where does the council and where does the local government actually look at that particular point, where they play the role of the regulator to ensure that there's an equitable outcome for all? I think South Africa's process of unity, by and large, has been successful if you take it to the rest of the world and the rest of the other areas. Of course, there are things we could have done better. But I think, by and large, what we did was the correct thing. By and large, what leadership, with the wisdom that they did have on both did was important. And I think that needs to be recognized. In fact, it is more recognized in the rest of the world than by South Africans. And hence they call South Africans continuously. That South African experience will be shared and should be shared. And that creates hope for a future world where people can resolve problems by talking, rather than killing.
For VOC News, I'm Dhakirodesai.